Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. Special Father's Day episode. Up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to have you joining me one more time on Life 2.0. This is the place where we hope to up the game a little bit, take a look at things that we don't always see, look in between the lines a little bit, find the music that remains hidden in between those spaces. And just in full disclosure, it is a glorious day here in Chicago on this Saturday, the day before Father's Day. And this seems to be the prime time, drop time for these shows when I put them up on Saturday. Sunday gets a little bit crowded, so I tend to drop these shows on Saturday. And I hope that wherever you're listening, it finds you well. Also, I got all the windows open in my studio. It is just, it's supposed to get near 100 again this afternoon. And I relish the non-air conditioning as much as I can. So you may be hearing some ambient background noise, such as birds, sirens, trucks, the neighbors, air conditioning, whatever it might be. So it's full disclosure here. We got the windows wide open. You know, Father's Day is one of those shows I don't even know that I wanted to do. I've done so many programs over the years for both Father's and Mother's Day and all the days in between that I never wanted to become redundant or repetitive or predictable. And so I started thinking about, you know, what do I talk about? My dad, you know, I mean, he's been gone since 2004. It never gets easier without him. It's in some ways I strain a little bit more each year to remember what his voice sounds like in my head. Of course, I have pictures of him and my mom around my office and other places, and it reminds me of some great times and also some difficult times. And I think for me that as time has gone by, not only has his voice become more faint, but so have the challenges and changes that we faced as father and son over time. Of course, that always shifts when you become a father, and pretty soon you go, yeah, the old man kind of knew what his shit was, and he knew what he was talking about. And also, you know, it's a tough role. There's no real, you can read all the books you want. I don't care how many courses you take or classes you take or books you read. There is nothing that prepares you to be a father fully until you take a jump in the pool. And that never ends. Once you're in the pool, in my experience, that never ends. My kids are in their 30s. I still think about them the last thing before I go to sleep and the first thing I wake up. I'm wondering what their day is like and how they are and what's going on. My son will be getting married here in the fall, and you know, I think that's going to be another layer for me. My daughter has overcome so many health challenges with her kidney disease and recently getting a transplant that I have nothing but admiration and respect for the journey that she's on. But even though I donated a kidney to her when she was just 13, there's nothing else I can do, right, except be there and put out good energy and thoughts. So that's how it is for me with my kids in their age now, in their 30s. And I think about my dad at my age, which is 60, none of your gosh darn business, almost 63. And my life and his life at that time were very, very different than my kids are with me. And that's just the progression of time. But I think about him often at this age that I'm at now. And his health, you know, we have very, very, very different lives. I think some of it's by design. Some of it's by choice, a lot of it by chance. But my dad was a banker for over three decades, almost 40 years. And he sat behind a desk a lot and made a bunch of monetary decisions and all that goes along with that. And I have this image of him, one of his most favorite activities, believe it or not, was doing his taxes every year. He had 19 different Ticonderoga number two pencils out, all sharpened to a razor point. And he loved nothing more than diving in and getting his taxes done. And, you know, this is when he all had a paper out, right? You'd write them and mail them in. Remember those days? There was a few years he did my taxes because the last thing I want to do was my taxes. But I've come to learn over the years to appreciate the procedure and the process. And I think at this point, he'd get a kick out of doing things digitally. But all that being said, my dad was a guy who always wanted to be an architect and never quite got there. The challenges and circumstances in his parents' life, they got divorced when he was, I think, in his later years of high school, made him go to work instead of college full-time. I don't think he ever really recovered from that. I can still recall getting up on Saturday and Sunday mornings early, and my pop would be downstairs at this ginormous dining room table just drawing things like an architect would. He had house ideas and, you know, construction ideas and renovation ideas. And while he was a pretty good architect off the record, on the record, he wasn't a real good carpenter. He was earnest, let's put it that way. He put his back into it and tried it as best he could, but there was a lot of unfinished projects in our house, which is sometimes what a contractor does, right? The contractor's jobs are the ones that are always finished last, if ever. So in that sense, I guess he was pretty successful. But, you know, there were doors that were never finished and overheads that were empty and things like that. And it wasn't, you know, a huge deal. But I think to him, and at least for me for sure, it was this reminder to finish what you start. If there was two or three lessons I take away from my dad, the number one is finish what you start. Doesn't matter what the project is. Give it your best. If it takes 10 days, great. If it takes 10 years, you still stay with it. And that has been one of the big takeaways over my lifetime. I've been able to apply that idea of finish what you start to every single aspect of my life. These podcasts are a perfect example. You know, there's no end date to these. You know, in radio, terrestrial traditional radio, if I was working for a radio station, I worked there until I wasn't working there, and then that ended. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But these podcasts, that's up to me. And so I started these 3 years ago. I have no desire to finish them, quite frankly, and stop them and let them go. So to me, every one of these stands on its own. It's a beginning and a middle and an end. I finished what I started, and this started about 7 minutes ago, and we'll see where this goes. And every project that I've been involved in, especially when it comes to writing books, are you kidding? You know, if you don't finish what you start with a book, it is the endless bestseller that never gets written. The discipline it takes to sit down and start a book once upon a time, no matter what that book theme might be or topic, and to work your way through that process literally over a period of years. My dad's lesson of finish what you start has come into play many, many times. And the other big takeaway from my dad, something he said that was a little startling to me, being the banking guy that he was and all about money management and things like that, was the best investment you can make is not in property, real estate, stocks and bonds, but it's in yourself. And I think that comes from his direct disconnect from being an architect, that he felt maybe if he invested more time back in the day, he wouldn't have got diverted and he would have been able to do what he wanted to do. He worked, as I said, for almost 30 plus years, for almost 40 for sure, in banking. And while he was adept at it, I don't think he ever enjoyed it. I can tell you what it was like. I have these images in my mind of standing out in front of my house. My dad would leave at 8:30 in the morning, walk to work, come back at 5:30 at night. Every now and again, he'd come home for lunch. But when I saw him leave in the morning, he was whistling and smartly dressed and had his Brill Cream slicked down going, and he smelled like Old Spice, and he was out the door at 8:30. It took him about 25 minutes to walk to the bank. And when he came home at night, he was a bit beat up, wasn't smiling. And I would see him at the corner. He'd take a cut across up past the expressway and walk through. And I'd see him walking in from the end of the block, just looking beat to shit. And I remember thinking early on that if I'm going to do something for a living, it better goddamn well be something I enjoy, at least most of the time. And that's not always the case, but at least that was what was in my mind as a kid. Of course, when he saw me, he perked up and like he became Superman again. But I remember him telling me numerous times, you know, the best investment you can ever make is in yourself. Find out what your talents are and your abilities and what drives you and what motivates you and who you are and who you're not. And take the time to do those things and then capitalize on that and move forward with that. And so when I first started in radio back in 1997, I'll never forget my dad saying, after listening to me for 3 hours on the air, "They actually pay you to do this?" It was a bit foreign to him as a guy who sat behind a desk and, you know, did this money stuff all day. And while he was a huge fan of WGN radio here in Chicago, he didn't connect the two. Those were guys on the radio. That wouldn't be my son. And when his son got on the radio in Michigan, he just was having a difficult time thinking that I could actually do that. Not because I didn't have the ability, but that it would be a long-term thing for me, that it would be safe and secure. Well, these days, there are no careers that are safe and secure. It doesn't matter if you're a teacher or a truck driver, things can change. So the 24th year in radio now for me, I have, it's kind of like baseball. You know, I think I've struck out more times than I've hit home runs, but the home runs have really, really, really paid off. But you keep swinging. And that goes back to that thing about investing in myself. There isn't a day that goes by that I'm not trying to learn something new, stay up to speed with the different shifting platforms and technology for broadcasting and podcasting. To think that I have the opportunity every single day to do a show that's international called The Bridge with rotating co-hosts in Beijing, China, with all that goes on in the headlines of the rift between the United States and China, that every day we're building a bridge, kind of a backtrack, just to talk like friends. I have these amazing co-hosts in China, and we've become friends over the last 10 months. And I find that far more exhilarating than pointing fingers, because you can point a finger at every nation on earth and there's something wrong, right? So, but I have friends on just about every continent. And I know when I talk with my friends, we talk about things that everybody's concerned about, the environment, raising kids, earning a living. And they have given me such a great perspective, a more worldly perspective, which I thought I already had. It's just expanded exponentially by having these conversations every day, 7,000 miles apart with my friends, Bebe, Hu Young, and Leo Yen. And Simsy Nichols, who is our producer, jumps in. And so she's in LA and I'm in Chicago and they're in Beijing. And it's an amazing human concert, if you will, that has just, I can't even tell you how much it's broadened my vision on things. And if you'd have told me back in 1997, when I first got in the air at little WDBC radio in Upper Michigan, with an hour a week for 5 weeks to get it done, that one day, even though it's two decades later, that I'd be doing an international daily radio show that would also be a podcast heard by millions of people, I'd be like, yeah, okay, what? Well, that's where it's at. But that comes from investing in myself. And that's one of the big takeaways, as I said, from my dad. Of all the things in the world that I think of him, and there are many, I just think of Halloween. More than anything else, this is a guy who for 10 months out of the year was a banker and 2 months out of the year was basically Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee mashed into one and becomes Dracula in September and October every year for well over 20 years. He lived for horror movies and science fiction and all the stuff that goes along with that. And, nothing gave him more delight than turning the basement on Berto Avenue into the haunted castle. And he and my cousins and friends put so much time, energy, and effort into building the mazes in the basement and scaring the living shit out of people, old and young. Doesn't matter who, they were all equal opportunities to scare the crap out of people. I just have such great memories of that. My mom would make him up. I put her work on my dad with any Hollywood makeup artist. Bone white face. He actually had real fangs made by his dentist. My dad had one of those widow's peak hairlines, right? So when you slicked back, he was the perfect Lugosi, Christopher Reeve mashup. And my mom actually took some black curtains. Why there were black curtains in my bedroom? I think she pawned it off at night. Somehow they were heavier and they would keep the noise of the highway out. And the same thing would keep it cool in summer. I always thought they were just kind of creepy. Looked like a shroud. Anyway, my mom would take these curtains. She made a cape out of them for my dad. Big cowl neck and all that kind of stuff. Oh, it's just nonstop. Matter of fact, the picture that I chose for this episode is my dad as Dracula, because that was the thing that gave him the most pleasure. So much so that when he passed away, as I mentioned in 2004, my sister and I made sure that that cape went in with him when he was sent off to Valhalla. So once a year, I think about him every day. His picture's right here in front of me, and it's hard not to think about him. But this time of year, you put the term Father's Day on and it gets me a little bit, and I'm always looking up, meaning I'm looking at my dad. I don't look at myself as a father. I look at as him as a dad. Oh, there's one of those delightful sirens. Pretty cool. I hope nobody's hurt and they catch the bad guy. But I look at him as a father. Like I said, I don't look at myself in the role as a father because that's not for me to determine. That's for my kids to decide on one way or the other. And because I am acutely aware that I have more yesterdays than tomorrows, I get more emotional the older that I get. It's gotten to the point where there's a couple songs we did on the Father's Day show that airs tomorrow on The Bridge. It's actually tomorrow there already. that I can only listen to once a year. There's a song by Conway Twitty. That's my job. Once a year, otherwise I'm done. You know, that's really it. And then Dance With My Father by Luther Vandross. Forget it. I'm on the floor in the corner, you know, with my nads hanging out because they touch a nerve in me because we know as fathers our time's coming. And we hope we've made the investments in our kids that will allow them to live without us, as we've had to learn, those of us who don't have our dads anymore or our moms, as we've had to learn to live without them. You know, I remember when my dad passed, I realized that I was an adult orphan to some greater or lesser degree. My dad passed in 04. My mom passed in 1997. No more phone calls, no more letters, no more connections, no more dinners, no more Halloweens, and all the things that, no more Christmas, all the things that go with that. And we take it for granted. It's part of the human condition to take every freaking thing for granted while they're here and while we're here. And when that is removed from us, all of a sudden the reality sinks in big time. At least it did for me. And so I cherish those days of Halloween back in the day. When I played football into college, I can still remember my mom and dad in the stands. My mom was a lot more vocal. Kill them, some bitches. That was my mom yelling. My dad would just be sitting there kind of just shaking his head like, go get him. So my dad was not an athlete. He was a great bowler, which to some degree is athleticism for sure. And we bowled together, I think, 4 or 5 years at the late night men's league at the Irving Park Lanes from 9 o'clock till midnight, and had one hell of a time doing that. But we've also had difficult times. You know, my mom was an alcoholic. My dad was a classic enabler. He just wanted her to be happy. And I have never found out in my lifetime or her lifetime what it was that drove her to that place. And once she passed away, then I think I shifted my anger with her and being cut short. She only was 59 when she died. I think I shifted it to my dad and blamed him a lot for it because, hey, he's still around. And so as fathers, you know, he took that. And it's a lot of it was warranted. But also during time, talking with him and understanding things and realizing he did the best he could with what he had where he was at the time, helped me to forgive him and helped me to forgive myself for just effing jumping down his throat. You know, people who are in pain, if they don't deal with it, they want other people to be in pain. That's just normal. That's kind of how humans are. But when you start to learn how to process your own pain, pretty soon you realize it's not about those people. It's about your response to those people and how you interpret things. So I am so glad, so thankful that my dad and I were able to find a great connection, great peace before he died. My sister and I was with him when he passed. It was a bright morning, much like today in May of 2004. And I literally stood there and watched all the pain and the angst and the anger and all the things that he carried in his lifetime lift from him when he passed. It was the most unbelievable sense of peace that I'd ever energetically felt in my life. It was just really, really a gift. It was a sad gift and bittersweet, but it was a gift nonetheless. And I started thinking about the other two fathers that I knew. My grandfathers. These two guys were as different as night and day. My maternal grandfather, my mom's dad, was Carl Gustav Bengtsson, a 5'8" pugilistic Swede who came to the United States at the age of 19 with $7 in his pocket and became, you know, an 80-hour-a-week mechanic at Greyhound bus lines over the years. I still have right here, not 10 feet away, hanging on the wall in my office, the cap that he wore. He was so proud of that cap. It's like a captain's hat from Greyhound bus with his name inside. And he would wear that cap with great pride. One of his great stories was that back when Muhammad Ali was still Cassius Clay and going to fight Sonny Liston, he was in a bus. And that was a Greyhound-built bus. And that bus broke down not far outside of Chicago, and they had it towed to the O'Hare garage where my grandfather worked. And he got the bus up and running in record time. And I have a couple of pictures of the champ and his bus that were taken by my grandfather. And there's one where there's, like I said, my 5-foot grandfather standing next to this 6'3" Muhammad Ali. And, you know, with their fists up. And my grandfather was a boxer when he was a kid. So I can't even imagine how much fun that was for him and how honored he was to help get that bus going. And of course, he took undeserved credit for Ali knocking the shit out of Sonny Liston and taking the title because he got the bus running. Because if the bus wasn't running, he never would have got there and he never would have won and all that goes along with it. But my grandfather, Carl, was was a guy who wore his heart on his sleeve, as I recall. In 1963, one of my earliest memories of him was when Kennedy was assassinated and they had the funeral, and I was sitting on my grandpa's knee. And they had that funeral procession on television, on the black and white TV, and my grandfather was just sobbing. Just sobbing. Everything that he felt America was had been eliminated at that point in his life in the embodiment of JFK. I don't know if he was Republican or Democrat, my grandpa, but whatever that was all about, whatever he came to this country for, the hope that he felt, the idea that America was, when Kennedy was assassinated, so much of that left for him. I remember him crying, just saying, they've killed our president. They've killed our president. I was sitting on his knee. I'll never forget. It's like it happened yesterday. And in so many ways, I think that was what hastened his early death. You know, when you lose hope, that's tough. My grandmother had passed in 1960, his wife, Laura, and in 63, Kennedy was assassinated. By 1965, my grandfather had passed away. And I have these snapshot memories of him, besides the JFK thing. We used to sit at the kitchen table, and he would just cut thick slices of limpa bread. It's a Swedish sweet bread called limpa. And that with Longhorn cheese was basically what he ate all the time. It was an old world diet for sure, but he would cut slices and talk, and he'd share things with me. Sometimes from a Swedish perspective, and talking about the old country, talking about his times as a boxer, talking about hunting. Matter of fact, there was, I don't know, 4 or 5 rifles that he had at the time. I've inherited all of those. At one time, I sold them when things were really difficult. A friend of mine stepped in and bought them all. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, offered them back to me. He had held those for me for, 8, 9 years. And I was able to purchase those long rifles back. And then I gave them all to my son, with the exception of a Civil War saddle gun that I have sitting here from 1864. But all those were my grandfather's, along with a couple of swords. And he was enamored with the West, and he thought John Wayne was the biggest thing in the world. But I remember him having these conversations with me and telling me things and about work and how important it is to be a good person, all that kind of stuff that sticks with a little boy, you know, sitting on his grandpa's knee. And I have, you know, just those thoughts of him. I have a bunch of pictures of him from the old country that are just so, so very precious to me. I look at them often, and I think of Grandpa Carly's here on my desk as well. There's a picture of him with in his handwriting of his Ellis Island photograph. And it's Carl Gustav Bengtsson, K-A-R-L-G-U-S-T-A-V-E, Bengtsson, B-E-N-G-S-T-O-N. That got changed to Carl Benson, like so many immigrants. Make it shorter, make it easier. So Carl Gustav Bengtsson is on the photograph, but he became Carl Benson. And he was a really important part of my life. I look at that hat, and I think of the work ethic. I think of him putting in the hours, boxing and bodybuilding. This guy made his own weight equipment, workout equipment, long before it was fashionable. Matter of fact, my son still has an exerciser with springs on it that my grandfather built at a forge. He made out of, you know, steel and metal and other things and put this thing together. And my son has it. And it was his love of weights and things that got me started. All his old weights and stuff somehow made it to our basement on Berto Avenue. And as soon as Pumping Iron came out in 1975, I hit the weights. I don't know how many times over the years my mom would say, boy, your grandpa would sure be proud of you to see what you've done with this. But the good thing is I have some of his muscle density, but at 5'8", that left when I was about in 7th grade, 8th grade, maybe something like that, which rolls me into my paternal grandfather, my dad's dad, Big John. Total opposite guy. 6'3", 6'4", 235, 240-pound German. Rough neck, rough and tumble, just, you know, living life on the edge all the time. Construction worker, entrepreneur, rule contour, you name it, this guy was in it. He was always pushing the edge to figure out something. And if you take my grandfather, Carl's 5'8", muscle mass and density, which was formidable for his size, and you slap it on me, and I have more of the 6'2", 6'3", stretch of my grandpa John, it was a pretty good combination. And it works for me still to this day. I look at the rest of my family sometimes, and I see them all short and wide. I'm thinking, boy, oh boy, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. I got the muscle mass over here and the height over here. It's worked for me. I'm really glad to have it. But Big John was a guy who lived life his way. And a matter of fact, when he passed away at his funeral in 1973, I remember that they played the Frank Sinatra song, My Way. And this guy in the casket, this big man, had this earring in his ear, and I didn't know why. And I asked my dad about it. He says, well, he always fancied himself a pirate to some degree. And so my memories of him are a little bit more fuzzy than my Grandpa Carl. He wasn't around as much, but when he was around, he was this overflowing presence that filled the room. You can't have a guy that size walk into a room, and you could just feel it when he came in. Of course, I was just a little guy at the time. But you could just feel it. He just brought something with him. And I think that's my takeaway that I feel sometimes that I may have picked up from him unconsciously or consciously, that when you're there, let people know you're there. You know, this is a guy who never once held back on his thoughts or his ideas. And whether you agreed with him or disagree with him, he didn't give a shit. I think I know someone like that. So, you know, it's quite a conglomerate. So on this Father's Day, I think of those guys that were my grandfathers, the things that I gleaned from them. And then you take that and you mix it in with my dad, and here I am. And of course, there's other influences. You know, the men that came before those two that I only know by name and a couple pictures that could have never imagined at the end of the lineage would have been a guy like me. You know, I am so opposite, as far as I can tell, of every man that's come before me. I'm the first person that I know of and that we've done digging and due diligence on that ever finished college. I'm the first one that ever wrote a book, became an author. For sure, the person who's, you know, the first in being in broadcasting and being out in the world as I am. All the rest of these guys were laborers and construction workers, and there was some entrepreneurism there for sure. But I think all of that has rolled downhill, served me well. Long before I had written a book, long before I was on the radio, long before I was doing The Bridge, long before I was doing TED Talks or all the other things that I've done, I was a laborer too. I know what it's like to run a jackhammer 6, 8, 9, 10 hours a day to earn a living. I know what it's like to run with concrete and build driveways and do things like that and frame up stuff. And so you pull nails at 7 o'clock in the morning on a rain day for 6, 8 hours. Now there's a good time. But all of those actions, all of those disciplines have played a role in everything else that I do. I can't even begin to tell you how important that discipline is. Even doing shows like this, you know, keeping a rigorous, consistent schedule in everything that I do has served me well. So why change it? Even when I was not on, quote, on the air broadcasting, I was doing podcasts. I was like, well, I'm not on the air now. Well, it doesn't mean you don't do anything. I could do something I can do in what I've been given to do. So I follow that along. And I think of those disciplines of those men that came before me and how that has played out in my life. It's extraordinary, really. And my dad, among all of them, you know, he's the one I spent the most time with, obviously. He's the one that I was closest to. He's the one that rubbed off on me the most. His discipline of going to work every day, getting up early at the same time, doing his thing, whether he liked it or not, was huge. Because I've learned that about 70% of what I do in life, I really don't like. But that doesn't matter whether I like it or not. It's what needs to be done. And so when I take all those pieces of that and I roll them into a big ball, that's what I think of on Father's Day, the lessons I've learned from these men that have come before me. And the fact of the matter is that they're all gone makes it even more of a challenge, because I think of them, and more often, I guess, you know, on this Father's Day, I would love nothing more to pick up the phone, call my pop, and just argue about the Cubs and the White Sox. Just go back and forth on that. That ended in 2004. And to this day, I still have a nudge here or there when something happens. It's very strange, but it's really deeply embedded in me that when something happens, I want to pick up the phone and call and talk to them. Or when something's going on in my career or my life or with the kids, I want to call and talk to them about it. Can't do that. So if nothing else on this Father's Day, if you're hearing this and you still have the opportunity to talk with your father, make the call. Even if it's hard, make the call. And here's why. Because at some point, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to everything. That's the fact. And so whatever seems to be going on right now in your life with your dad, if it's a great grand thing and you have no problems, fantastic. You're going to make the call already. But if it's been difficult and you have challenges, that's when it's most important. Because I can tell you that regret and difficulty after the time comes when that call can't be made, that is shit to live with. I've had a little bit of it. I know other people have had, you know, stuff with it. And I know people that are pissed off at their parents and they've been gone for 40 years. And it colors their life to this day. So on this Father's Day, as the birds are starting to take over the yard and the traffic is starting to build, I'm gonna cut out of this. And I just want to wish all of you dads out there a great day. You deserve it. And if you haven't lived up to the billing of dad, there's still time to do that. And I know, at least from my own experience, being a father has changed my life immeasurably. I look at it this way. Before my kids were born, my life was one way. After my kids were born, my life was a different way. Sometimes those things intersect and overlap, but I am a better man because they're here. And I've had to step up in ways I never thought that I could. And so it is the greatest opportunity that I've had to become a better person, even though I've fallen down so many times I can't even imagine or count. And I have faltered, but never wavered in this pursuit of being a father. My life is rich beyond measure because they're here and because I get to say I'm a dad. Until next time, safe travels. Be well. Adios.
I woke up crying late at night when I was very young. I had dreamed my father had passed away and gone. My world revolved around him. I couldn't lie there anymore. So I made my way down the mirrored hall and tapped upon his door. And I said, Daddy, I'm so afraid. How will I go on with you gone that way? Don't want to cry anymore, so may I stay with you. And he said, that's my job. That's what I do. Everything I do is because of to keep you safe with me. That's my job, you see. Later we barely got along, this teenage boy and he. Most of the fights, it seems, were over different dreams we each held for me. He wanted knowledge and learning. I wanted to fly out west. I said I could make it out there if I just had the fare. I got half, will you loan me the rest? And I said, Daddy, I'm so afraid. There's no guarantee in the plans I've made. And if I should fail, who will pay my way back home? And he said, that's my job. That's what I do. Everything I do is because of you, to keep you safe with me. That's my job, you see. Every person carves his spot and fills the hole with light. And I pray someday I might light as bright as he. Woke up early one bright fall day to spread the tragic news. After all my travels, I settled down within a mile or two. I make my living with words and rhyme, and all this tragedy should go into my head and out instead as bits of poetry. But I say, Daddy, I'm so afraid. How will I go on with you gone this way? How can I come up with a song to say I love you? That's my job. That's what I do. Everything I do is because of you, to keep you safe with me. That's my job, you see.